Looking for your next favorite podcast? Start here.
It was in everyone's interests, especially that of the bees, to build a better beehive. And in 1852, the US Patent Office awarded patent number 9300A to an American clergyman named Lorenzo L. Langstroth, often known today simply as the Langstroth Hive.
Jazz and swing were the creations of black musicians who played in Prohibition-era mob-run city dance halls to swarms of increasingly white teenagers. Conservatives and aging feminists alike shunned these places as dangerous for vulnerable young women.
Awesome. I know I was personally sitting in the Mecklenburg Beer Hall watching the goals rack up, and we had the KC game like kind of not on our phones as far as like watching it, but just watching like the Google alerts or whatever, and it was just like no.
Today, samples from 50 things that made the modern economy, American hysteria, and Cincinnati soccer talk. Welcome to Start Here from Cincinnati Public Radio. I'm Trip Eldridge, your podcast jockey. Each week, we sample and highlight three podcasts to help you navigate the exploding podcast world and maybe find your next podcast obsession. Plus, get an email summary of each podcast we feature with our weekly Start Here email blast. Just go to wvxu.org/subscribe and select the Start Here blast email at the bottom of the page. And if you like what you hear, please rate us at Apple Podcasts. A 5-star rating will help others find us in the iTunes gallery. With special thanks to Cincinnati Public Radio's Wiser Advisors, Jim Nolan and Kevin Reynolds, and writing research and curation support from Connor Eldridge, let's start here. Whatever device you're listening to this episode on owes a lot to the tech that came before it. Some trends come and go, of course, but others change the way we live forever. You can explore the history of some of the unsung technology that shaped the world as we know it today with the BBC World Service's hit show, 50 Things That Made the Modern Economy. On the podcast, economist and journalist Tim Harford tells the fascinating stories of inventions, innovations, and ideas which have helped shape the great economic world. All 50 items from Season 1 are available via Podcast Central, so you can catch up as you wait for new episodes of Season 2 to be released each week. Now, whether it's paper money, department stores, or that S-bend plumbing pipe at the bottom of your sink, every item and idea we know has a history. Here's a sample clip for you from the first episode of Season 2. The episode examines the importance of the Langstroth Hive, a simple wooden box that allowed for the industrialization of bees and the mass production of honey. In this clip, Harford describes the history of honeybees as both an economic metaphor and as producers of a much sought-after product.
And when a future winner of the Nobel Memorial Prize in Economics, James Mead, was looking for an example of a tricky idea in economic theory, it was to the honeybee that he turned for inspiration. The tricky idea was what economists call a positive externality. It's like a kind of topsy-turvy pollution, something good that a free market won't produce enough of, meaning that the government might want to subsidize it. For James Mead, the perfect example of a positive externality was the relationship between bees and apples. Imagine, wrote Mead in 1952, a region containing some orchards and some beekeeping. If the apple farmers planted more apple trees, then the beekeepers would benefit, because that would mean more honey. But the apple farmers wouldn't enjoy that benefit, that positive externality, and so they wouldn't plant as many apple trees as would be best for everyone. This was, according to Mead, due simply and solely to the fact that the apple farmer cannot charge the beekeeper for the bee's food. Close your eyes, and you can see Mead's example coming to life. The haze of early summer, the cool shade of the apple trees, the buzz of the busy bees. No wonder the example has been handed down the years. It's vivid, evocative, and entirely mistaken. Apple blossom produces almost no honey, and that's only the first thing James Mead didn't know about bees. To understand Mead's more fundamental error, we need a brief history of humans and honeybees. The Greeks, the Egyptians, and the Romans were all partial to domesticated honey. By the Middle Ages, beekeepers were using skep hives. They're the classic woven beehives that look like a tapering stack of straw tires. The trouble with skep hives is that if you want to get the honey, you need to get rid of the bees. And beekeepers would generally poison them and worry about getting another bee colony in due course. People started to worry about this waste and disdain for a creature that not only gives us honey, but pollinates our plants. It was in everyone's interests, especially that of the bees, to build a better beehive. And in 1852, the US Patent Office awarded patent number 9300A to an American clergyman named Lorenzo L. Langstroth for a movable frame beehive, often known today simply as the Langstroth Hive. The Langstroth Hive is a wooden box with an opening at the top and frames that hang down, carefully separated from each other by the magic gap of 5/16 of an inch, or 8 millimetres. Any smaller or larger, and the bees start adding their own inconvenient structures. The honeycombs are easily pulled out and harvested by a spinning centrifuge that flings out, filters, and collects the honey. The Langstroth Hive, a marvel of design and efficiency, allowed the industrialization of the bee. It's this industrialization that James Mead hadn't quite grasped. The honeybee is a thoroughly domesticated animal. With Langstroth hives, bees are portable. Nothing stops farmers coming to some financial arrangement with beekeepers to locate hives amid their crops. A couple of decades after James Mead's famous example, another economist, Stephen Chung, became curious about it, and he did something we economists perhaps don't do often enough. He called up some real people and asked them what actually happens. It turned out that apple farmers pay beekeepers for the service of pollinating their crops. For some other crops, the beekeepers indeed pay farmers for the right to harvest their nectar. The market, Mead said, should exist, but couldn't. So apples and bees aren't a good example of a positive externality because the interaction does take place in a marketplace, and that marketplace is huge. These days, its centre of gravity is the California almond industry. Almonds need honeybees, 5 colonies per hectare, rented for around $185 a colony. Langstroth hives are duly strapped together, loaded onto the back of articulated lorries, 400 hives per truck, and driven to the Californian almond groves each spring, travelling by night while the bees are asleep.
From the podcast, 50 Things That Made the Economy, from the BBC World Service. Become an expert on everything from cellophane to elevators with 50 Things That Made the Economy, available on WVXU's Podcast Central. New to the Podcast Central collection this week is a podcast called American Hysteria. It's a show that explores our moral panics, urban legends, and conspiracy theories, how they shape our psychology and culture, and why we end up believing them. Every 2 weeks, host Chelsea Weber-Smith dives into the sometimes hilarious, sometimes distressing stories of modern and historical American freakouts, why we fear the wrong things, and what these bizarre panics might be covering up. You'll hear the stories behind such infamous bouts of hysteria as Y2K and the Mayan calendar, the swine flu epidemic, and the so-called gay agenda. Were any of these concerns founded? No, but thanks to American Hysteria, we can go beyond the panic and see what these events reveal about what we fear and how that fear spreads. Here's a sample for you from a recent episode of American Hysteria titled Teenage Sex. From grinding to sexting to Snapchat, parents have always been incredibly concerned with their children's sexual activity during the teenage years. This episode travels back to the 1920s to the advent of teenage culture to explore the roots of this moral panic, the failure of sex ed that perpetually leaves kids in limbo, and the grand urban legends that parents have believed about their children's private lives.
Another sex panic occurring around the same time was spurred on by this same conversation around sex acts other than going all the way. Also known as shag bands, sex bracelets were those cheap jelly bracelets in different colors that come in and out of style. Depending on the color of the bracelet, young girls were apparently signaling their potential for various sex acts to wanton boys or displaying the prizes they had gotten for already performing the acts. This color code ran an impressive gamut of possibilities, from the tame, like kissing and hugging, to oral sex and intercourse, to the shocking, like analingus and fisting. The color codes in every story on these sex bracelets varied, as did the methods by which this new phenomenon was functioning. Some adults claim that it was part of a sinister new game called Snap, where boys would walk by and break one of the bracelets, and determined by the color, the girl would have to immediately perform the indicated sex act for the boy. There's no real evidence that either of these urban legends have any basis in reality, but they're still talked about even now as evidence that kids these days are out of control, a feeling that seems to repeat with the new, slightly more shocking trends of each generation. Let's start with the first generation of American teenagers, who were beginning to form a brand new identity, full of new freedoms and righteous rebellion, ready to decide things for themselves. As the thousands of teenaged veterans returned as shell-shocked adults from the extreme violence of World War I, the youth heading into the 1920s was profoundly angry with the older generation for creating the hellish reality that so many of their own had been living in, and they showed more distrust, less willingness to simply conform to their parents' wishes. With the sudden economic upturn of the Roaring Twenties, young people finally had freedom to leave the days of child labor behind, and those that had the means to party certainly did. America soon got to know their very first counterculture, led in part by young girls who had experienced expanded horizons while working as part of the war effort, and were much more liberated than anyone had ever seen. Nicknamed flappers, these teenage girls and young women cut their hair short and wore short dresses. They drank, smoked, and danced, and canoodled with boys they were not set to marry, a very different picture from the way young women had acted in the generations before. Almost immediately, these flappers were seen as a brand new national threat. An op-ed from 1922 from a concerned mother claims that these vampire women, which they called vamps, were preying on their good little boys, claiming her son had recently confided,
"Mother, it is so hard for me to be decent and live up to the standards you have set me, and to always keep in mind the loveliness and purity of girls. How can I do it with this cheek dancing? And if I pull away, they call me a prude. And when I take a girl home, in the way that you have told me is the proper fashion, she is not satisfied and thinks I'm slow."
The dances this concerned letter likely referred to were the hip products of jazz, widely called the devil's music, with its unstructured freedom, its beating rhythms and moaning tones. The style it inspired certainly broke social norms. Jazz and swing were the creations of black musicians who played in Prohibition-era mob-run city dance halls to swarms of increasingly white teenagers. Conservatives and aging feminists alike shunned these places as dangerous for vulnerable young women, with the president of the General Federation of Women's Clubs stating, as she led her personal crusade against the new culture, that, quote, "Jazz was originally the accompaniment of the voodoo dance, stimulating half-crazed barbarians to the vilest of deeds."
A sample from American Hysteria from Skylark Media. Get to the bottom of every controversy and conspiracy, from the witch trials to the coming apocalypse, with American Hysteria. Now available on WVXU's Podcast Central. Summer's right around the corner, right? Well, in Cincinnati, that doesn't just mean baseball anymore. That's right, summer means soccer, FC Cincinnati to be specific. Newly appointed to the MLS, FC is poised to make a name for themselves among the best the country has to offer. And you can keep up with all the club's scores and news, hear player interviews, and keep up to speed with the MLS in Cincinnati Soccer Talk. Created by fans, for fans, the Cincinnati Soccer Talk is a perfect place to keep up with your team or get on board if you're new to the club. Just like you have to be there to experience the energy of an FC game, you've got to listen to the podcast to get the full stories. We've checked out a little sample for you from a recent episode in the March to Match Day series, which previews the upcoming matchups for the clubs. The episode previewed the recent match between FC Cincinnati and Sporting Kansas City, which I had the honor of being part of, and it ended up resulting in a tie. Here, host Nick Suberling and his guest Jimmy Mack provide in-depth breakdown of FCC's matchup, Sporting KC.
Jimmy, I want to talk last week and the 2019 Union, so here we go. So, not something you commonly see in Major League Soccer. Sporting KC scored a touchdown last week in the 7-1 thumping of Montreal. Tell us a little bit about that match and just what worked so well for the club.
Yeah, that was quite a game to watch. It was sort of the perfect union of everything Sporting KC does well, all coming together at the same time. We had our best starting 11 out there, which hasn't always been the case every game this year so far, because with the CCL games, as you mentioned, there's been a lot of rotation in the Sporting KC squad. It was at home at Children's Mercy Park, and Sporting KC was coming off a long international break, even though players like Johnny Russell did play and travel a lot for their teams. He played for Scotland. Christian Namath and Botan Baroth played for Hungary. Most of the team got quite a long rest, didn't have too many minutes played over the international break. And I think they were just ready to come out and hit it hard. They also got a little lucky. Montreal did not have Nacho Piatti. They also didn't have Diallo in starting center back. So Montreal wasn't quite at full strength, but it became pretty apparent from the first kick that Sporting KC was going to come out, press hard, attack as hard as they have been all throughout 2019, and they just kept up their goal-scoring form. Christian Namath has slotted in at striker for Sporting KC after returning to the club last year. He played with Sporting KC in 2015, mainly as a winger before going overseas for a bit and then joining the Revs. He had a hat trick. He scored 8 goals across 7 matches in all competitions so far. Johnny Russell had a brace, who's been tearing it up since joining from Derby County in the English Championship last year. Even 16-year-old Gianluca Buzio got on the score sheet. Really what it was Sporting KC was pressing hard on defense, never let up off the gas pedal, even when they went up 3, 4, 5 goals, and just did a really good job playing out of the back. I would say that's the one thing that they've done this year that they didn't have last year, even with Aiko Parra, is they build out of the back and they're very comfortable under pressure against high-pressing teams. I haven't had as much of a chance to watch FC Cincinnati as I would have liked. I know they're sort of built with a strong defensive midfield. I don't know if they press high or not, but that's been one of Sporting KC's strength, is building out of the back, getting around that pressure, and then striking fast on the counter.
Awesome. I know I was personally sitting in the Mecklenburg Beer Hall watching the goals rack up, and we had the KC game like kind of not on our phones as far as like watching it, but just watching like the Google alerts or whatever, and it was just like no, yeah. Not another one. And so that was pretty, you guys entertained us for sure. Most Major League Soccer fans know Kansas City is an annual powerhouse. That's a no-brainer. But can you let our fans know, what is Peter Vermees' style, and how do you think he's going to line up against FC Cincinnati?
Sure. So Peter Vermees, he's in his 11th year as manager of Sporting KC. He's the longest tenured manager in MLS. And Sporting KC fans will tell you that the thing about Peter Vermees is he's very consistent in his style. You know what you're getting from Peter Vermees week in, week out. He plays a 4-3-3 formation, and you're going to get a 4-3-3 formation. It's a very possession-oriented style of play. Very rarely does Sporting KC ever lose the possession battle. That doesn't always translate to goal scored or offense, as I'm sure you guys know, but it's not uncommon to see Sporting KC with 60 to 65% possession. This year, especially, as I mentioned before, they've been focusing on building out of the back. The center back who stepped in place of Aiko Parra, Andre Fontes, he's very good with the ball at his feet. Matt Beisler is also very good with the ball at his feet. Tim Melia likes to pass it to them, and they build from the back line to that midfield. The midfield is probably the unsung heroes of this team, the way they connect the back line to that dangerous front attack that's had Johnny Russell, Christian Namath, and Gerso Fernandez, who is generally the fastest guy on the field against any team he plays. it's just they've been so successful at keeping the ball, not panicking under pressure, and then just picking their spots, finding the right pass. And if you looked at some of the goals they scored against Montreal, that's exactly what they did. They'd weather the storm, weather the high press, and then Roger Espinosa would pick out a gorgeous ball over the top to Gerso that would bring him free. Or Ilya Sanchez would do the same thing. So having said all that, what will be interesting against FC Cincinnati is we are going to be in the midst of a 5-game in 16-day streak, and we're going to be coming off 3 days rest playing at Monterey at altitude in the CCL with the second leg following just 4 days later. So this might be one of the rare situations where you might actually see Peter Vermees potentially switch up the formation or play some players that don't normally get minutes because they're going to have some squad rotation.
A sample from the podcast Cincinnati Soccer Talk. Support your team by supporting its fans. Listen to Cincinnati Soccer Talk now on WVXU's Podcast Central. To the charts we go. Our weekly visit to the Apple Podcast charts to see what's rising to the top around the nation, as compiled by iTunescharts.net. Debuting last week and instantly vaulting to number one is the new podcast, Sports Wars. From Wondery, Sports Wars takes an in-depth look at the greatest athletic rivalries of all time. And they start with an epic comparison, Green Bay's Brett Favre and Aaron Rodgers. Host Dan Rubenstein from Sports Illustrated and SB Nation takes you from grudge matches to the pranks, from the tantrums to the triumphs. What really happened? Who was right? Who was wrong? And you can decide whose side you're on. Number one on the Apple Podcast charts, the new podcast, Sports Wars. Thank you for joining us for Start Here, Cincinnati Public Radio's Discovery Podcast. For more information about podcasts we like, check out Podcast Central at WVXU.org. And remember, if you've got a podcast or an episode you'd like to recommend, email us at podcast@wvxu.org or call us at 513-294-8030, and we'll add your voice to ours. For now, I'm Trip Eldridge for Cincinnati Public Radio, and thank you for choosing to start here.